Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This is continuing coverage of the case against Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
What exactly is wrong with Lori Vallow Daybell? If you came here to find out, you're in the right spot. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a doctor. I can't diagnose her. Many others have, though, and many others have speculated, and that's what we're going to be doing on this episode. We are actually going to go through the clinical diagnosis of what the hell is going on in the mind of Lori Vallow Daybell as best as we can understand it. It's really hard to put yourself in a brain like that. But we're going to do our best to kind of connect the dots from piece to piece. And sometimes once you get a better idea of how that brain works, things make a little more sense in a situation where not a lot makes sense. So let's dive into it. And I want to hear your comments in the comment section on our YouTube channel, if that's where you're watching this. If you're listening to the podcast, hey, check out our YouTube channel, join in our conversation over there. Please press subscribe wherever it is you're watching or listening to us so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case and the many cases that we follow for you right here at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. So it's not every day you hear someone calmly say, Jesus knows that no one was murdered in this case at their own sentencing for the murders of their own children. But that's what exactly took place when Lori Vallow Daybell was in court. She stood in court looking serene, almost radiant, and delivered a closing monologue that sounded more like a spiritual TED talk than a statement from a convicted killer. She talked about near-death experiences, how her kids were communicating with her from beyond, and how, in her words, everyone was happy now. Not grieving, not traumatized, just happy. It was one of those moments that made the entire courtroom pause, like, did she just say that? And yeah, she did. No. Finching or flinching, no cracking voice, no visible grief. And that's not just disturbing, it's clinically significant. Because the woman standing there wasn't just detached or cold. According to the experts who spent months evaluating her, she was operating inside a completely different reality. Not metaphorically, literally. And you need to understand that if you're going to try and understand Lori Vallow Daybell. In 2023, ahead of her murder trial, Lori Vallow Daybell underwent a full psychiatric evaluation by a court-appointed mental health professional. This wasn't some defense tactic or PR move. It was of the legal process. Idaho law requires that a defendant be mentally competent to stand trial. That means they have to understand what's going on, who the players are, what they're being charged with, and be able to assist in their own defense. Now, sounds fancy, doesn't it? Sounds like, oh, that's quite a bar to get up to. it's like if the goalpost in a field football field just tipped over, fell into a ditch, were washed down a river, put into a canyon as the river overflowed, and now your goalposts are about 500 feet below sea level. When they were at level, that's where they're at. It's not a high bar. It should be high, but it's not. And for a while, Lori did not meet that bar, not surprisingly. She was actually ruled incompetent back in 2021 and sent to a state hospital for months of restorative treatment. Something I think we'll look back on in history going, oh, restorative treatment. What a funny idea that is for someone like her. What the hell were they thinking back then? But after nearly a year of being medicated, monitored, and treated by professionals, the judge ruled her competent. She was cleared to face trial, and that's important because it tells us two things right off the bat. One, that her mind had at least outwardly stabilized enough to engage with the legal system, at least according to the court-ordered psychologist, which I think you'd have a lot of other psychologists not exactly agreeing with that assessment, but, you know, who am I? And two, that there was a detailed, formal psychological profile sitting in her court file. And when that profile was revealed to open court, it laid everything bare. According to the official diagnosis, Lori Vallow Daybell was suffering from what's called delusional disorder, mixed type, with bizarre content and hyper-religiosity. It's a word I have a hard time saying. That was the primary diagnosis. She was also diagnosed with a personality disorder, unspecified, with narcissistic and histrionic features. Again, not a shock. Now, let's break that down without sounding like a psych textbook. Delusional disorder isn't your run-of-the-mill anxiety disorder, okay? Or depression. It's a severe psychiatric condition where the person has fixed false beliefs, delusions, if you will, that aren't grounded in reality, but that they believe with absolute conviction. And when we say fixed, we mean concrete. You can show them evidence, videos, eyewitness, DNA, and they won't budge. The belief is locked in. What sets it apart from something like schizophrenia is that the person doesn't necessarily lose touch with all aspects of reality. Not all. They might still pay their bills, go to work, cook dinner, but there's a segment of their thinking that's completely unhinged and protected like it's sacred truth. In Lori's case, those delusions were labeled as mixed type. You know, a better mix of the 80s, 90s, and today. Strange delusions, wanting to kill your kids, thinking they're zombies. Everything that makes you feel good and picks you up, and a no-repeat workday guarantee. That means more than one kind, not just grandiose, not just whatever the hell was going on there, not just religious, a little bit of everything. But the key phrase the psychologist added was bizarre content with hyper-religiosity. That's not just a technical description. That's a clue. It means her beliefs weren't just extreme. They were objectively implausible. Stuff that's completely detached from the physical laws of the world, like believing that people can become zombies. Or that someone's spirit can be taken over by a demon named Ned Schneider. It's not a metaphor. It's not metaphorical. In her mind, these were real conditions that required real-world solutions. The hyper-religiosity part is important, too. It doesn't mean she was religious. It means her religious beliefs were driving her delusions. They weren't personal faith practices. They were the framework for a whole alternative universe, complete with spiritual rankings, divine missions, and what she believed was God's plan, in which she played the starring role. And then there's the personality disorder. It wasn't specified down to one type because she didn't check every box for any single category, but the traits that stood out were narcissistic and histrionic. And yes, they can overlap. They do in many. Just a lot of people don't end up killing their kids thinking they're zombies. Narcissistic meaning a persistent need for admiration, a sense of entitlement, and a profound lack of empathy. And histrionic meaning attention-seeking, dramatic, superficial, emotional displays. Think of it as a kind of person who believes they're the center of the universe and performs like it's a stage. The two traits together often create a very toxic cocktail of self-importance, manipulation, and emotional detachment. And that fits the courtroom version of Lori Vallow Daybell to a T. The way she carried herself in court was off. Observers described her as serene, even upbeat. She'd smile, whisper to her attorneys, flip her hair. At one hearing, she was caught laughing while the judge was speaking. When footage from the jail was shown, graphic, heart-wrenching evidence of what had happened to her kids, she showed no emotion. She left the room at one point. But when she came back, it was as if she'd reset, stone-faced, not devastated, not even uncomfortable. And then came the sentencing statement. No apology, no acknowledgement of guilt, just a monologue about God, angels, and her dead children being happy and busy. You know, they're working at the Costco in heaven, in the afterlife. She said she knew this because they had visited her. According to her, Jesus confirmed there had been no murders. She spoke about vibrations, spiritual planes, and near-death experiences, as if that should, you know, clear things up. She was talking to a judge who had just overseen a months-long trial with DNA, digital footprints, witness testimony, autopsy reports, and she looked him in the face and basically said, "You've got it all wrong. I know the truth. Jesus told me." Now again, the court found her competent, which means she was rational enough to follow along with the legal process, speak with her attorneys, and understand the charges. But the diagnosis of delusional disorder tells us that within that outward rationality, there's a closed loop of belief that's untouchable. The delusions don't need to affect every part of your life to be dangerous. In her case, they affected the part that involved deciding who was good, who was evil, and who needed to die. And what makes this especially disturbing is how those personality features bolstered the delusions. It wasn't just that she believed bizarre things. It's that she believed she was the one chosen to carry them out. The narcissistic traits gave her the confidence, the righteousness, the immunity to guilt. The histrionic traits helped her draw others into her orbit, even in court. She behaved as if she were misunderstood, not monstrous. It was theater. But theater with a deeply disturbed subject and script. The diagnoses didn't come out of nowhere. They were based on months of psychiatric observation, structured interviews, and behavioral analysis. And what's important to note is that this wasn't a tool for her defense. In fact, Idaho doesn't even have an insanity defense, so this wasn't a strategy. It was a clinical necessity. The state needed to know whether she could stand trial, and when they looked into it, what they found wasn't someone pretending to be unstable. It was someone whose entire worldview had taken a hard detour from reality, and who still, to this day, believes she's on the right side of something bigger than all of us. The court didn't have to speculate. They had evaluations, reports, witness testimony, and their own words. What they saw was a person whose mind was broken, but not so broken that she couldn't sit in court and smile through it. That's the thing about delusional disorder. It doesn't always look like chaos. Sometimes it looks like calm. Sometimes it looks like conviction, charm even. And sometimes it looks like a mother who murdered her children but swears she's saving souls. Whatever Lori Vallow Daybell is thinking now, it's not happening on the same channel as the rest of us. The court said she was competent, but the diagnosis confirms that she's still living in a world of her own making. Before Lori Vallow Daybell stood in court smiling through a murder conviction, before she claimed Jesus told her no one was really dead, and long before anyone had dug up the shallow graves of her children on her boyfriend's property, or husband's property, there was a different version of Lori, a version people remembered from years back. Was it the woman you saw in the orange courtroom monitors? This Lori was a doting mom, bright, charismatic, the kind of person who was always in control of the conversation. She could charm strangers, organize a carpool, even plan a family trip, and recite scripture in the same breath. She was also the type who seemed to swing hard, whether in love, faith, or fury. Her world operated in absolutes. You were either on her team or you weren't. And if you weren't, things got cold fast. Before everything unraveled, Lori had already been through a string of relationships, 5 marriages to be exact, but who's counting? But nowhere in those early chapters was there any sign of violence, let alone murder. Custody battles, yes. Restraining orders, one. Emotional intensity, definitely. But not the kind of psychology that made national news or pathology that made national news. People close to her described her as a passionate, even obsessive woman at times, especially about her faith. She was raised in the LDS Church, Mormon, and that identity shaped a lot of her early adult life. But even within that community, Lori's belief would eventually take a hard turn into something unrecognizable. By all accounts, the breaking point, the spark that lit the fuse, the man named Chad Daybell. He wasn't a celebrity. He wasn't a scholar. He was a former cemetery sexton. And if you're playing along at home and don't know what that means, grave digger, who'd reinvented himself as an end times author. Think doomsday fiction mixed with theology, published under the radar and passed around among circles already leaning towards apocalyptic thinking. Chad wasn't just writing stories. He believed in what he was selling. According to his own accounts, he'd had near-death experiences that gave him a veil-thin connection to the spirit world. He claimed he could communicate with the dead, see beyond the physical realm, and knew who was destined to survive the coming apocalypse. It's niche stuff, sure, but for somebody already teetering between devotion and delusion, it can become gospel. Lori first encountered Chad's work around 2018. At the time, she was still married to Charles Vallow and living in Arizona. On the outside, it looked like a normal suburban life. Inside, things were starting to shift a little. Lori began reading Chad's books obsessively. Then she attended a religious conference where Chad was speaking. That meeting turned into a connection, and the connection quickly turned into a shared belief system. Some have referred to what they built together as a cult. But at that point, it was really just two people feeding each other's fantasies until they felt the truth, or like they had the truth. Lori, according to friends, started saying she had lived past lives. She had been somewhat important. That she was chosen. Then when her language started changing, she wasn't just talking about God or scripture anymore. She started using phrases like zombies, translated beings, dark spirits. Chad had developed a system where people could be rated on a spiritual light-dark scale. If you were a light spirit, you were safe, good, even celestial. Haven't y'all wanted to be celestial at some point? But if you were labeled dark, that meant your soul had either been overtaken or replaced entirely. And if you had a life insurance policy, they liked that. Lori picked up on this quickly. She started labeling people around her, friends, family, even her own kids. And it wasn't playful name calling. It was their belief system. Once someone was declared dark, or worse, a zombie, Dawn of the Daybell, they were no longer fully human. Their body was seen as occupied, corrupted, expendable. It was spiritual warfare masquerading as a personality conflict. Still, at this point, no crimes had occurred, but the ideology was getting sharper, stranger, and more rigid. Lori didn't just believe in end times prophecy. She started identifying as one of the chosen few. Chad told her she was an exalted being, and she ate that shit up. He said she lived multiple probations, lives essentially, lifetimes, and had been royalty even. And this is what she really liked. A goddess.
Whoa, ho, ho.
Don't pull that rug out from under Lori. Lori embraced that role, to say the least. She believed she was one of the 144,000 souls chosen to survive the end of the world and lead others into the next phase. That number, 144,000, comes from the book of Revelation. But in Chad and Lori's world, it wasn't just a number. It was a mission. Around the same time, Lori began withdrawing from her existing life. Her marriage to Charles was crumbling fast. Charles became alarmed, not just because his wife was getting more religious, but because her behavior was becoming unrecognizable. She told him he was possessed by a dark spirit named Ned Schneider. I don't know where you go with Ned Schneider, but okay. She claimed that he had already died spiritually, and something evil was living inside of the shell, essentially, of Charles. Charles didn't shrug this off. He went to the police. They didn't do anything. He told them his wife was mentally unstable and that he feared for his life. Again, nothing. That's where I think the police really need a close look at here in terms of how they responded to this thing. He even filed a petition to get her evaluated. And for a moment, the system responded. Lori was taken in for a brief psychiatric evaluation in early 2019, but it didn't stick. She talked her way through it. The doctors didn't see enough evidence to hold her involuntarily, and within a few hours, she was released. You know, see something, say something, nothing happens. Charles, meanwhile, tried everything he could think of, therapy, legal filings, law enforcement reports to try to protect his family and bring Lori back to reality. But the further he pushed, the deeper she went, and it wasn't just Chad whispering in her ear. Lori had a growing circle of followers, friends, acquaintances, and even family members who were drawn into the strange spiritual structure she was helping build. Some of them were true believers. Others may have just been riding the charisma train. Or they were just batshit crazy. But the effect was the same. Lori was insulated from doubt. She was surrounded by affirmation. She wasn't wrong. She was chosen. One of the most telling moments came when Lori started referring to her teenage daughter, Tylee, as dark. It's unclear exactly when this shift happened, but it marked a dangerous milestone. Up until that point, Lori's apocalyptic talk had focused on outsiders, on enemies, or on people who disagreed with her. Now it was moving inward. She began viewing her own children through the same binary lens, light or dark, ally or threat. When someone you love becomes an obstacle to your mission and you believe that obstacle is no longer fully human, it changes the moral math. It creates a loophole, a crack in the ethical wall. That crack widened fast. By mid-2019, Lori's behavior had changed so much that even those closest to her were a bit confused. She was talking about portals and spirit communication as if it were as mundane as grocery shopping. She claimed to have divine access, that God spoke to her directly, that she could see into other realms. She and Chad were texting back and forth constantly, talking about spiritual battles and timelines for the end of days like you do. At one point, they created a spreadsheet. Yes, an actual spreadsheet, like an Excel of people, and rank them based on how closely or close they were to God or how possessed they had become. That's not religion. That's a filter for who lives and who doesn't. It's worth noting that Lori didn't see any of this as extreme. To her, it wasn't fringe or fanatical. It was revelation, enlightenment. She didn't think she was losing control. She thought she was finally stepping into her purpose and more in control than anyone else. That's part of what makes these belief systems so dangerous. They don't announce themselves as madness. They arrive as clarity, a new lens, as if you're already inclined toward black and white thinking, if you're already used to flipping the switch on people who challenge your reality, then that new lens feels like a gift, feels like the truth. And by the time summer 19 rolled around, Lori Vallow Daybell wasn't just a woman in crisis. She was a woman convinced she had divine authority, that certain people were no longer people, that the world was ending soon, and she'd been handpicked to help shape what came next. And that's the version of Lori that walked straight past red flags, legal warnings, and mental health interventions like they were static in the background. She wasn't ignoring reality. She was replacing it. Of course, belief systems, even extreme ones, aren't crimes, but they can become the scaffolding as horrific acts. And when those beliefs begin to justify erasing the people around you, that's when the dissent stops being theoretical. That's where the real-world consequences start. There's a photo of Lori Vallow Daybell taken not long after her children disappeared. She's smiling. Lays around her neck, standing on a beach in Hawaii with her new husband, Chad Daybell. The sun is out, waves behind them, and she looks radiant, relaxed. You wouldn't think, just from that image, that back in Idaho, police were searching for her kids, that her teenage daughter and her adopted 7-year-old son hadn't been seen in weeks. You wouldn't think there were questions swirling about where they were or if they were even still alive. You certainly wouldn't guess that they were buried in a shallow grave behind Chad's house. That's the thing about Lori Vallow Daybell. Once her belief system locked in, she didn't live in the same version of reality as the rest of us. She lived in Lori Land. And in Lori Land, what she was doing didn't feel like running from the truth. It felt like walking in it. Let's rewind again. Back to July 2019. Charles Vallow, Lori's then husband, is dead, shot by Lori's brother, Alex Cox, during what was officially ruled a case of self-defense. Charles had come to Lori's house that morning to confront her about her mental state and try once again to get help for their son, JJ. What happened inside that house is still debated. But what's documented is that Charles ended up dead on the living room floor, and Lori didn't seem all that fazed. Police body cam footage from just hours after the shooting shows her outside the house, smiling, even joking with officers. She tells them it was a traumatic morning, but she doesn't look shaken. She's light, casual. You think someone just ran over her mailbox, not that her husband had been shot in front of her kids. Later that day, she ordered pizza, took JJ to Burger King, made plans. The world kept spinning. Lori spun right along with it. This wasn't the behavior of someone covering their tracks. It was the behavior of someone who didn't think they had anything to hide. Because in Lori's mind, Charles wasn't Charles anymore. He had been overtaken, possessed. And when you got someone that's possessed, well, in Lori Land, you got to kill him. Replaced by something evil. And once that switch flipped, once she accepted the idea that he was no longer her husband, but a dark spirit in his skin named Ned Schneider, his death wasn't a tragedy, it was a necessity. Justified, maybe even righteous. And that's where you start to see just how far her delusion had taken her. Not just in belief, but in behavior. Her emotional reaction didn't line up with what had actually happened. But it made perfect sense inside the alternate moral universe she had created with Chad. And Chad, by the way, wasn't just a background character during all this. He was a full co-author of the fantasy. The two of them existed in a feedback loop, what psychologists called a shared psychosis, or a faux adieu. It's a rare phenomenon, but not unheard of. Two people, usually close, romantic partners, siblings, develop a thing and they reinforce the same delusion with each other. Often it starts by one of them. The other buys in, and before long it becomes their shared reality. In Chad and Lori's case, it wasn't beyond conspiracy thinking. They believed they were on a divine mission to prepare for the end of the world. They believed they could spiritually assess people, assigning them light or dark ratings. They talked about zombies, again, not in pulp culture like they were watching the latest episode of The Walking Dead, but as people whose bodies were now under the control of evil spirits. In their minds, once a person became a zombie, their soul had already departed. Killing the body did not end a life. It released it. It's almost humane in their mind. This is how murder gets reframed as salvation. So when JJ and Tylee disappeared in September of 2019 and Lori told no one and made up stories about where they were, it wasn't just deceit, it was delusion with structure. She told people JJ was with friends, Tylee was at college, she sent texts from her phones, she even lied to police when they came knocking. But when you looked at her during those moments, during interviews, during phone calls, she was not frantic. She wasn't nervous. She was calm, smiling. She'd laugh, make jokes, deflect like it was nothing. Told her friend Melanie Gibb that Tylee had become a zombie, though. Like you do. That JJ, he had become a zombie, too. In her version of reality, that meant the kids weren't really her kids anymore. They were vessels. Shells. And the ultimate example of compartmentalization, a defense mechanism where the mind walls off one part of reality from the rest, Lori could live one life in Hawaii, newly married, tan and happy, while her kids were decomposing in Chad's backyard. She could go to the beach, sip a drink, order wedding rings online, all while investigators are trying to locate her children. The horror and the honeymoon existed in two separate files in her brain, and she never let them overlap. That kind of psychological splitting is what it's called. It doesn't happen overnight. It's usually the result of a deep internal conflict, cognitive dissonance, that becomes too uncomfortable to bear. On one hand, Lori saw herself as a good mother, a chosen leader, a woman fulfilling God's plan. On the other hand, the reality was her children were dead, and she was involved. So how do you reconcile that one? Well, you don't. Not in the traditional way. You shift the narrative. In Lori's case, that meant reframing everything. She didn't kill her children. She saved them. The spirits, or their spirits, were free now. They were happy. Still with her, just in a different form. She wasn't a murderer. She was a liberator. And because her delusion was so complete, she could cling to the idea that, with total conviction, this was real. Even after the bodies were found, JJ wrapped in plastic and duct tape, Tylee dismembered, melted, and burned in a bucket in Chad's backyard. Even then, Lori stuck to the script. She told the court she had spoken with them, that they visited her from the spirit world, that they were at peace. She said they were busy and happy. On the other side, she said no one had been murdered, that everything that happened was part of a divine plan. This wasn't just denial in the casual sense. It was a full-blown cognitive self-protection, a mental firewall against guilt. And the thing is, it worked for her. It seems to still be working for her. When she sat in that courtroom, she did not look like someone bracing for punishment. She looked composed, even amused at times. During testimony, when her only surviving son, Colby, got on the stand to tell her he couldn't understand how she did this, she mouthed, "Oh, my baby," like a mother embarrassed by a moody teen. It wasn't remorse. It was performance, a kind of detached sympathy for someone who just didn't get it. By the time sentencing came around, Lori had had years to process the evidence, to sit with the consequences, but none of it cracked her armor. Not at all. She stood there and delivered a speech that that felt like a spiritual victory lap. She didn't address the jury. She didn't apologize. She talked about vibrations, about Jesus, about her children visiting her and Tammy Daybell. She was free now. She denied that a murder had even occurred. Not once did she refer to what had been done to JJ and Tylee. Not once did she say their names in grief. The deaths weren't deaths. They were transitions. Because in Lori land, people didn't die, they ascended. And that's the chilling part, the thing that sticks with you. That even now, after everything, after the evidence, after the trial, the conviction, she still believes she's innocent. Or maybe more than that, she believes she's right. She didn't get there overnight, and she didn't get there alone. Once she crossed that psychological threshold, once she found a belief system that could justify anything, it allowed her to be unthinkable and kept smiling all the way through it. Because once you build a world where good means harm and where harm means salvation and the only truth is the one you create, well, in that world, anything is possible, especially the worst. That's Lori Vallow Daybell for you. What do you think? You understand what's going on there? You agree? Give me your thoughts in the comments.
This is continuing coverage of the case against Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Be nice when Daybell is over. But there's going to be more. Today we're diving into one of the most twisted family sagas in modern crime history. The case of Lori Vallow Daybell, the so-called Doomsday Mom. What started as a strange tale of religious obsession spiraled into a chilling series of deaths. Her children, her former husband, even her new husband's previous wife, for added measure, all gone. Lori's been convicted now in two states. But beyond the headlines and courtroom drama, we've got to ask, how does a seemingly loving mother come to believe her kids are zombies and that God wants her to help send them to the afterlife? You know, like a good loving mom does. To help us unpack the tangled mess of delusion, manipulation, and likely undiagnosed mental illness at the heart of all this, we're joined by psychotherapist Siobhan Scott, who's seen the kind of psychology that turns ordinary people into self-proclaimed prophets of destruction. Siobhan, to kick us off, is this a case, now that we've gone through another trial of, you know, pure evil, or is this someone who's truly lost herself in a dangerous belief system? And what's the line between delusion and calculated destruction here?
Yeah, it's fortunately, we don't see many people like her in the world. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a rare combination of somebody who, you know, some of the evaluations, I've read summaries about her mental health. And again, I have not met with her, but these are people who have met with her, and there were some summaries online. You know, somebody who had a pre-existing personality problem with traits from narcissism and histrionic, which means attention seeking, somebody who really, you know, can manipulate people just for the sake of attention. And of course, narcissism, that's a big one to unpack, but somebody that is always out for themselves and manipulates and uses people. A lot of negative qualities with that. So somebody that had this pre-existing long-term personality type who then in her 40s became delusional. And delusional disorder it's kind of confusing, so I'll break it down a little bit.
Okay.
Because delusion means you have bizarre beliefs that mm-hmm. absolutely cannot be true. Mm-hmm. And it's different from something that's a brain disease like schizophrenia, because that's where somebody also has a lot of confusion, loose associations. They don't make a lot of sense when they talk. And, you know, those are the people on the street talking to the telephone pole or ranting, you know, to invisible people that they're mm-hmm. seeing that no one else can see. But delusional disorder, the person can look very normal in most of their life. And they may function well in a career or an occupation, or they may do a fairly good job of raising their kids, except for this one area. And she became increasingly religious starting in 2017. She'd always been religious in the LDS faith, but became obsessed and these bizarre things that were out of, you know, the canon of the church you know, family members noticed that she was becoming increasingly odd. And so delusional disorder like that allows people to still function. You don't look at them and immediately know they're crazy. But this content of the delusions for her is grandiosity. She thinks she's a goddess. She's an ascended being. She talks with angels and Jesus all the time. So things that we would look at, okay, this is out of the norm even for a religious person. It's too extreme. And then, of course, when she met Chad Daybell, who also had delusional disorder, the two of them fed off each other and developed this paranoid sense that the zombies and the demons were after them. And it was a terrible combination, the two together, terrible combination. And then with her pre-existing personality problems, with this layered delusional disorder on top, it's, you know, very dangerous.
Is there something... I'm sure it's different in every case, but is there something that triggers the delusion disorder? How, like, seemingly, like, 1 month they can be, you know, they can look at something that would be crazy and go, that's crazy. And then the next, it's like, oh, totally normal. This makes total sense to them. Is there something that, like, triggers it, pushes them over an edge where suddenly, you know, black is white and white is black, and they seem to not be able to comprehend that just not that long ago, what looks crazy is now completely healthy and normal?
Yeah, I don't think we can identify that there's something that causes it. That's a great question. We would love to know that. But it does seem to be a disorder of the brain, and there are probably genetic factors. You know, most kinds of severe mental illness like schizophrenia develop in the late teens or early 20s, but delusional disorder seems to kick in the 40s, and we don't really understand what is it. You know, possibly about the aging brain that mm-hmm. sets some of this off for people.
Is it literally just like the pathways are firing to the wrong places, and then the human, as it comes out, it's just, okay, that's, it feels like this is the right place, so I'm just going to go with this. And then everybody else seems to be completely off except for them.
Yeah, it's an alteration in their thinking process, in their way of perceiving the world, and it's relatively uncommon, but fortunately uncommon.
When they're getting pushback, like from the rest of the world, like Lori Vallow certainly has, do they recognize that? I mean, do they go, wait a second here? People used to be like kind of on my side, or I could like integrate into society just fine and life was fine. But when suddenly the whole world looks at you and goes, you're wrong, you're just completely off, why does that not somehow kick something off in their brain to go, maybe we should reevaluate if everyone is suddenly telling us we're wrong? Maybe there is something wrong. I think when most people, if suddenly you're really off on some way of thinking that, and you don't have delusional disorder, but somehow you perceive something one way and, oh shit, I'm really wrong on that. They never have that moment. It seems like it never happens. And they somehow believe it's them against the world.
Exactly. And it's that paranoid quality that makes them so dangerous. It mm-hmm. really is them against the world in their thinking. And it's almost like the more that they're confronted with, you know, this can't possibly be true, they double down and then everybody else becomes the enemy. And we know in Lori's case, Charles, her husband, was trying to get through to her and trying to be logical and trying to be rational. And what ended up happening to Charles? You know, they killed him. And one could go on and say that had this been unchecked, there would have been other deaths that followed, because anybody who opposed her was going to die.
I know we don't see this type of disorder, at least to the level that Lori Vallow Daybell has shown it on a common level. But are there a lot of people out there that are just kind of waiting in wake where it's not even like up to them, but it's like they're just kind of a step away from getting to Lori's level? Folks who are hyper religious, and I'm not trying to knock religion here, so nobody take it that way, but mm-hmm. some folks are just super hyper religious to the point where, and this is my own experience of seeing an individual in my world a while back, someone I was close to in a romantic relationship who was very religious, but had, and I've seen it in other people too, this
this complete lack of care for life or death, where they believe they're not of this world. They will literally say that. There's things where everything is the enemy. Anything negative is the enemy. It's the devil.
Right.
And they're reckless. I would see it in driving patterns. I would see it in just ways of putting themselves in dangerous situations where death could occur for themselves or others, especially if they're like in a driving type situation. That to me felt a bit delusional, where they're willing to kind of put their life on the line because they're good with death at any moment in time. They're not there to live this life because they think the other side is all of it. And everything here, I've checked the box, I'm done, I don't want to be here anymore. I mean, some would look at that as suicidal, but it's not quite like that. It's more like, well, when God takes me, he takes me, and that's just how it's supposed to be. Never mind, I'm, you know, going the wrong way down a highway or something like that.
Wow.
That sort of thinking. I mean, it's not complete delusion. It's not to the level of Daybell, but it's the religiosity in it that seems to allow them to go to such a length without regard for themselves or others and be completely fine and happy the way that Lori Vallow has presented herself. Are there a lot of people out there like that where like they could step over that line to Daybell territory pretty quick?
We hope there's not a lot of people out there like that, but I hear you on, I think it's probably a continuum with religiosity and a lot of people who are probably fairly well grounded in reality still believe that prayer helps in some way. Kind of difficult to prove that scientifically, but it's a, you know, harmless belief system. They're not out seeing the devil everywhere, but you do see a continuum. And I think that's one of the difficult things is, how do we know where to draw the line between something has veered into dangerous category? We do see a lot of cases. We've had some in Oregon where people who believe in faith healing and are very religious have allowed their children to die because they've denied them medical care, and they end up prosecuted and usually convicted. And so at what point does society step in and say, you know, you're endangering people here? It's a very tricky gray area, and people can debate about it a lot.
Sure. Were you surprised? At least I was about this. The lack of religiosity that she intertwined into her questioning, her lines of questioning on cross in this trial. She didn't present any sort of defense. I was kind of surprised by that. But she didn't go into crazy territory. And when she did talk about Nephi from the Book of Mormon, it wasn't in any sort of extreme ways. It was just, why do you think I'm only going down the road of where God commands him to kill people? There's all these other books of Nephi and all these other things that he did. Why do you think that this is the only road that I would be going down? She didn't get into zombies. She didn't even entertain these things. And I was kind of surprised by that because that's not the Lori Vallow we all know and love. It to me showed a sense of control. It showed a sense of awareness that I didn't think she had, where she knew if she went down that road, it seems it wasn't going to play well to a jury, and the jury wasn't going to see it from her perspective. I was kind of thinking she was oblivious to what the jury thought, and she was going to use it as a platform to preach. What was that? I mean, the consciousness of it was a little spooky because it made me think maybe Lori is in a little bit more control than we all think she is.
That's another interesting aspect of this, because people have gotten feedback when their ideas are considered nutty, and they know it's not going to serve them to share that, you know, with the general public. They do seem to have the ability to control it. And even if that's what's going in their head, they don't talk about it. But I was surprised as well that, you know, she didn't veer off into that more during the trial. But, you know, I've mentioned this to you before, but when I was in undergrad school for psychology, I was volunteering on a mental health crisis line and, you know, take calls in the middle of the night from suicidal people or strange people, people who were disturbed. And there was a man in the local community who was a medical doctor with a thriving practice. And he was a very good doctor. People liked him. He seemed normal, but he had a delusion. He had delusional disorder that the local Catholic hospital was euthanizing people. And he would call in the middle of the night when he was agitated and upset, and he would want us to take action in some way against the Catholic hospital. And so he would write letters, and he would do all these, you know, crazy things. Obviously, the Catholic hospital was not euthanizing people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this was something he really did believe, but he was able to keep it contained and still function in a medical practice and do a decent job. So that was one of the strangest cases that I'll never forget.
I mean, and is that dangerous then to have somebody like that in the position they were in, where clearly he was separating it, you know, for a long time, maybe forever. But the fact that he's like one, you know, whatever, iota away from seemingly I could see something going wrong in his medical practice or something, and suddenly he's, you know, integrating some other weird belief over there, and nobody's catching on until it's too late, and he's, you know, he's euthanizing people or something.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it seems weird. Like it could go bad very, very fast.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have somebody with delusional disorder, you know, should they be in medical or in medicine, or should they be, I mean, are they qualified to be in really much of anything that where there could be a risk to human life?
Yeah, no, I was very concerned at the time and took it to a supervisor. And I think because of confidentiality and no imminent danger, I don't think that we could report it or, you know, do anything. But yeah, very concerning. You don't want your doctor to be delusional. You really don't.
No, no. Let's talk about histrionic disorder. You know, I know more about it too, but I don't know that the audience knows a ton about it. It's gotten thrown around a lot with Lori. I know that she was diagnosed with it as part of her whole cluster of things. Explain that better. I know grandiosity is a huge thing to it, but you know, what is kind of the general definition of it, and how does it apply to Lori?
Yeah, people who can be very dramatic and do very big emotions, but they're very superficial. And typically women with histrionic personality are flirtatious. And I have often thought about Lori, the way she engages with people, even the way she engaged with the police after Charles' death, and kind of flirty and giggling. There's this undercurrent of sexuality that they tend to leak, even when they get very old. You'll see, you know, people in their 70s and 80s, and they've still got this girlish little coquettish manner. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly something that I've seen with her. There were even times in court where she, you know, she just kind of does this little voice and does this little flirtatious kind of routine. Mm-hmm. But they can get a lot of attention because of the way that they put themselves out there in front of people. They enjoy the attention.
Yeah. And then they get the feedback loop going where it's like, oh, this works.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do they, I mean, obviously a lot of these things are very debilitating. A lot of times people don't recognize that they have them, don't seek help. And, you know, and people get pushed out of their lives, and they just kind of go from, you know, like a tornado from one place to the next until people catch on. For somebody like a Lori, I mean, obviously Lori's pretty extreme here, but anyone who sees some of these diagnoses that Lori has, and maybe they have someone in their life who has one of them or both, or God, I hope not, or all of it. But let's say you got some of them. I mean, is there much treatment? Is there ever pulling anybody back from a delusional disorder through therapy, through medication, through anything? Or sometimes is it just, look, this is the road they're on, this is how their brain works, and we don't have a way to correct it at this point?
Unfortunately, it's the latter. Yeah, we have not found really any medication that would significantly impact the delusional disorder, unlike schizophrenia or other kinds of disorders where there's psychosis. Medication can be very effective and just sort of knock the delusions and hallucinations away. Mm-hmm. But with delusional disorder, that has not been proven to be true. And they're not open to therapy because if the therapist tries to give them an alternate version of reality, well, then they flush the therapist. You know, mm-hmm. then the therapist is part of the zombie troop or whatever. They do not want to hear reality. And so they're very resistant to talk therapy. Medications don't seem to work. They're just who they are. And I think with things like narcissism and histrionic personality, I will say sometimes they can succeed in Hollywood. I think you do see a lot of celebrities who are very attention-seeking, very sexual, very flirtatious. You watch the award shows and you look at what people are wearing and you go, okay, that's a little attention-seeking there.
Yeah.
But, you know, for having somebody in your life with these qualities, you're just stuck with them. And usually it's the family members who go to therapy to go, oh my God, my sister, my mother's driving me nuts and I don't know what to do about that. And we can help the family members.
Yeah, to try and cope with what they're, it's like Al-Anon, but it's for this, essentially. Exactly. Yeah, award show, like the most personality disorders under one roof at one time that have not been diagnosed or accepted. Yeah. Were you surprised at all by some of the things that she was saying in trial? What she was trying to justify, I thought was interesting, specifically about her reactions to what took place the day that Charles was shot. Her story in court, and it seems she planned this out, like, okay, I'm going to say this, and everyone's going to think this is great, was you do know that, you know, when someone's under a lot of stress, they get dehydrated. So that was the justification for Burger King. That and Charles had promised the kids that, oh, we're going to go get Burger King, and then he's dead. So she has to make up for that, taking to Burger King, and she got water because if you're stressed, you need the water. Mm-hmm. In her mind, when she's in that cell, is she thinking, damn, that's going to land good? People are going to hear that, and they're going to be like, oh, well, that explains all of it.
Exactly.
Did she think that going in, or was she just, in her state, just throwing things at the wall at that point?
Yeah, it shows this little cunning quality she has, this manipulation. And she comes up with these things that sound absolutely ludicrous, but I think she does convince herself, well, of course, you know, this makes perfect sense. The other thing that I thought was, well, you know, her story, this wasn't any sort of planned killing. This was just a family tragedy. Mm-hmm. And so we're all supposed to have empathy. Oh, how sad, a family tragedy, you know, which is completely bizarre. Her hand was in all of this, in all these deaths.
Yeah, I mean, the family tragedy. The thing is, I think she believes it's justified. The family tragedy is filled with delusion, and that's the problem with it. I think she views it as a family tragedy, but I think the tragedy in her mind is that, you know, Ned Schneider is possessing Charles, and then he has to die. It's so tragic that he had to be killed because Ned Schneider is – it wasn't that your brother killed your husband out of whatever that was. Let's talk about that relationship a little bit. A brother that goes to that that extreme for his sister. And let's assume that, you know, there wasn't imminent danger here. I don't think Charles was attacking anybody. But Alex thought this is a time to take him out. And I don't know that Alex was as delusional as she was. It's hard to know. He's dead, obviously. But the fact that he was kind of her henchman, what do you think was going on there?
Really, really weird family relationship, huh? Because it sort of smacks like a cult member, like somebody who is so under the control of one of these, you know, really powerful, emotionally powerful people. And Lori and Chad certainly fit the profile of cult leaders. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like he just bought into it and was there to do their bidding and meet their needs and found a great deal of identity from his role and felt important. It's certainly just another layer of bizarre that a brother would murder the way he did.
And there's been a lot of talk over the years because it just seems like you're too close. You're too close to your sister. This is weird where you're going. I mean, I don't have any siblings, so it's hard for me to like relate to people with siblings. But just from the outside, you look and go, okay, you know, of course you're going to be there for your sibling. You're going to look out for them. You got their back, that sort of thing, if you're in a good relationship. But to this level, it made you really wonder what else is going on here. And there had been reports from people who had, you know, witnessed their interactions over the years at get-togethers and such. I'm sure there was green chili chicken enchiladas going on. As we know, Lori's a great cook of those. That's one of the major points we learned in this. And they allegedly, there was a lot of, faux sex play, if you will, where it looked, they'd be joking and acting out sex acts on each other, brother and sister, to be funny. What the hell's going on? If you're doing that, that's a little odd. Is that not, if you're doing that with your sister, and not like they're doing it in public or anything, but the fact that you're even like emulating this in front of other people, that can't be healthy.
No, it's completely creepy. Non-clinical word, creepy.
Yes,
but yeah, really pathological and a huge red flag. And yet nothing about this case would surprise me. So
yeah. When you see siblings, and I'm not even necessarily speaking about this case in general, but are there cases where you see siblings, a brother, a sister, whatever the combination may be, where that's going on? And it kind of explains some of the devoted behavior to such a weird degree, where they almost kind of take on the role of partners to each other, like what you consider like a romantic partner, but they've somehow deluded themselves to thinking that, this is how this is. I mean, I get it. I don't get it. But, you get it like out in the sticks or something, where it's like, okay, this is kind of an inbred family. But the ones that are like out there, every day in real life, like Lori was, like Alex was. Does that exist? I'm sure it does to some extent, but do we see that where there's that weird level of closeness, and somehow that's the bond that keeps them together?
Yeah, you certainly can see it, but I don't think it's as common. There's certainly incest between siblings that happens, but it's usually it's usually the older brother, significantly older brother with a little sister, something is going on. And that's traumatic.
Yeah.
That ends up pushing people apart and causing chaos in the family. But to have an enmeshed, almost romantic couple bond between siblings, more rare, but yeah, it's certainly possible. And that would explain a lot of his weird devotion to her.
Yeah, it does. It certainly makes you wonder. I think we'll never know the answer to it. I know I've talked with the normal brother, the healthy one. He has said he never believed he saw that. He never thought that was going on. But you only see so much. He wasn't super connected to a lot of them for a long period of time. So I know it makes you wonder. I don't know that I want to know the answer, but it certainly makes you wonder.
Yeah.
If true crime is your obsession, we've got you covered. Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today for nonstop coverage, expert insights, and in-depth analysis. This is continuing coverage of the case against Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Well, of course, we have the guilty verdict, and we have another trial coming up, and we'll get to that. I'm Lori Vallow Daybelled out. I was hoping for a little more excitement in this trial. I was hoping for a little more crazy. We got quite a toned down version of Lori. We got Lori light, and without any, pretty much religion free, other than just her discussing Nephi and the interpretations of it. Not anything magical. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. It's wrapped up. But that one, how do you think it all went?
Way faster than they thought it was going to.
Yeah.
I think they had it penciled in for 5 weeks, and I think they finished it in a week.
Yeah.
I thought that Lori, like you said, I mean, she really toned it down. She didn't look like a buffoon playing attorney, I mean, she learned the legal jargon and she, she was competent, and ultimately, my biggest takeaway is that Lori Vallow Daybell just doesn't make good green chili chicken enchiladas.
Yeah.
That was really kind of my big, out of the whole thing. Because, I mean, you're sitting there watching it, and we all know what a monster she is. Mm-hmm. We know she's convicted in Idaho. The jury, in theory, doesn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're looking at it from a strictly objective perspective, under, you know, under the guise that the jury doesn't know what a piece of shit she is. Mm-hmm. And like, you're looking at it, okay, is the state proving the conspiracy case? And I'm like, you know, leading. And that was one of the cases where I was saying, look, I'd say in 90% of trials, if not higher, the jury has made its decision long before closing arguments. The closing arguments aren't the thing that sways people. Mm-hmm. Like that, that's your last ditch effort. Mm-hmm. Like, and you can give that whatever weight that you want to give it, because it's just argument. I think that most people have their minds made up at the time. And I kept saying it during our lives. I'm like, this thing is sitting in not guilty world unless, unless the state can really hit a home run and tie all these pieces together in its closing argument, really kind of pointing out why all these little circumstantial pieces lead only to one place, and that she knew what was going on. She played a part into it, and they did.
Yeah.
Like the prosecution, for as critical as I was of the prosecutor during the trial itself, I thought she did a phenomenal job in closing, and she got the job done. I mean, she laid it out. She laid it out exactly like she had to.
Well, I thought she did a phenomenal job. The best part was the very end, where she was rebutting what Lori said and then throwing it to the jury. That was where we finally saw, I think, what a good prosecutor she is. Because otherwise, I was critical too. I'm like, she's not engaging, or it felt very monotone. It felt like the same, and it wasn't a pleasant tone either. It was very hard to stay with her. It wasn't that her points were off. She just wasn't a great presenter, I thought, of the facts. And I don't know. I was sitting there in not guilty territory thinking, if they know nothing about the kids, I don't know how you completely show this other than they're speaking in code. And, and you know, I was kind of amazed. I never thought I would feel that way, but Lori did a pretty good job arguing her point for not being an attorney. I thought in the closings, she did good. I actually, at the end of that, thought she's got about a 20% chance that I think she could be found not guilty.
Yeah.
I think
I probably shrunk it down. Like I went,
was that 10? I went to 20.
Arguments, I was 80-20 that they're going to come back not guilty just because the state hadn't proved it up.
Yeah.
By the time closings were done, I had flipped.
Yeah.
I thought, like 80-20, maybe 90-10.
Yeah.
I thought that there was still a shot, but I just thought, I thought the state was very, very convincing at the end, and they really tied it up very neatly for the jury and really put it on display, you know, why the circumstantial evidence that did exist could only lead you to one conclusion, you know, and it was a tough prosecution because they could not bring up all of the shit that she's done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just like, it was tough, man. So
and
Boudreaux is going to even be a tougher case.
I'm just beginning to dive into where that's going to go. That'll probably be a conversation for next week. But do you think the judge gave her too much of a leash to work with? I mean, there were several times where she very easily could have gotten the kids involved into this. And the judge kind of was the bumper. Like, whoa, you sure you want to do this? Are you just let her do it. Let her do it. Like how much of a handholder do you need to be as a judge? Obviously you're trying to prevent this from becoming an appellate issue.
You just answered your own question.
But she chose to be her own attorney. If she's about to put shit in there that's not going to be good for her, why don't you just let her?
It's still going to be because ultimately it still is an appellate issue.
Yeah.
Like his primary goal, and it's a lot less, I mean, in terms of being an appellate issue, it's a lot less, powerful in terms of being a really strong issue for the appeals court in terms of getting this thing back for a retrial, but it's still an issue nonetheless. If she opens the door, you know, because even though he gave her a huge, all the things you want to hear a judge saying to a defendant prior to allowing them to defend themselves, pro se, and he went through it all. He's like, your educational level, you can read and you can write, you understand the law to a certain extent. And, she answered all of it right. But, if he's going to err on the side of caution, and he wants this thing to stick, it was the right move.
Yeah.
It was the right move because, you know, I mean, she'll always, like, you can't make a claim of ineffective assistance against yourself. But, you know,
if anyone could, it's her.
Right. The judge is still the gatekeeper of the evidence. And, I think that would have, it would have blown apart the whole trial. It probably would have had to have been, you know, but you can't make the mistake and then ask for the mistrial. That's the thing.
Yeah. That's my point.
Yeah. I mean,
like,
so
well, just,
I
don't know, just let her sink her boat. But you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, he was the most patient judge in the world. I thought with her and,
but I mean, she made it pretty easy in the sense that she didn't drone on for hours asking a ton of inane questions. Yeah. I mean, like this thing ended in 7 days. He was thrilled.
Yeah.
But this judge had blocked off 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, he might move another trial into the, now that he's got some open spaces, but she just bought this judge like like 4 weeks of chilling.
He should go to that beach in Hawaii where she got married and just sit there with a cocktail.
Exactly.
And send a little, a selfie, like love to Lori.
But I'm saying, man, I'm over her. I'm done with her.
I know.
Let her go rot.
What was your reaction at the very end when she was found guilty? And then she just pretty much acted like, I don't care. Just get this over with as fast as you can. When does the court want me back? Like, well, you got to decide. Well, just went out. Like, she didn't, you know, argue anything. She pretty much just said, do whatever the hell you're going to do to me.
Yeah. I wasn't surprised.
No.
You know, I mean, like, look, if no matter how she was acting at trial, I think that we all have an understanding, if we know anything about her, that she is still convinced the end of days is coming and she's the one. Like, to her, this is all just a bunch of mishigas. It's all like, okay, I'm going to go through the motions. Yeah. I'm certainly not going to make myself look like an idiot, and I'm going to go in there and I'm going to try the case, but I don't care what the result is because you know what, suckers? This shit's all coming down. And I know it's coming down. Yeah. And when it does come down, I'm golden. So
I took it as that. I took it as that too. And some people are looking at it as, see, it's an admission. Look at, she's giving up. Like, no, it's not that. It's not an admission. No, it's not that. She just thinks she's smarter than the rest of the room. 100%. And she doesn't have any care for what happens to us mortals here on the plane because she's the goddess of Rexburg.
Yeah. And look, dude, we'll leave it at this.
Yeah.
We can all take great solace in the fact that she's going to spend the rest of her life in prison and the fact that she makes a really, really shitty green chili chicken enchilada. I love that, man.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.